Hello and welcome to Human Quest, episode 371. I'm your host, Wheels Age, and with me, as always...
Leader of the Veil Guard, Rennie Foma Master.
And yes, oddly enough, I am now finally feeling some excitement for Veil Guard after playing BioWare's worst game. I don't know how that happened.
Yeah.
But yes.
I don't know what happened.
The long rumored to happen eventually stream of Pew and I playing Anthem has occurred.
It's like the second or third time you've streamed Anthem.
Yes. And we had some fun. We sat through some very long loading time. Oh, I forgot to turn on the subtitles again. Sorry, I'm playing Dragon Age 2, and that was a game from the age before that was just on by default.
Before you could set it on in your, like, system.
Yeah.
Defaults.
Yeah, and Pete makes a good point, too. We had random... We actually match made into other people playing Anthem.
Absolutely nightmarish.
Yes.
People must be more animal than man at this stage. It's what happens when you're abandoned by God.
I mean, if you're wondering why, you know, it's like...
Like 5 million people bought that game.
And yeah, I've played some other live service games. Anthem is better than First Descendant. Or is it Last Descendant? First Descendant? I don't know. It's better than that one. That game sucks.
I don't know what that is, but I believe that it's real.
Imagine Destiny, only it's made by, like, a generic Chinese mobile game maker.
Okay, that's a lot of live service games are, like, imagine a AAA game but made by a, like, mobile game company that has extreme amounts of success somewhere in East Asia.
I tried to play it because my 11-year-old son played it for some reason. And it was like...
Here. He has now been grounded.
Here's a giant lore dump at the beginning that makes no sense. Pick your generic anime character. Run around with this character whose name is Bunny.
That's weird.
And I was kind of just lost from that point.
Go.
It kind of just sucked. I hated it.
I noticed. Yeah, so that's congrats on
the Anthem.
Anthem?
You were there. You partook in the fun.
I was. Well, I saw it. I didn't partake.
That's true.
I'm scared of being asked to partake the next time, but
they could have had a contender.
I can understand why they did not.
Yeah, no, I look at it and like the combat, there's something in there that's very, very good, and it's easy to look at it and say, hey, if you had like pumped some money into this, this could have been something really good. But based on some of the weird bugs and the horrible loading times, it's quite possible there's a lot that's incredibly broken.
Under the hood, some like real... there's probably some real horror shows under there.
Yeah.
Because, like, they just had to stitch up what they had and get it onto a shelf. Mm. I feel like, essentially, the other thing is that maintaining Anthem would have kind of had to have been a studio's full-time job.
Mm.
And so, like, at some point, I'm sure that someone was looking at fixing up Anthem and then realizing, like... Oh, if we do this, we don't make Dragon Age or Mass Effect anymore. This is our job now. Anthem's failure did make a huge difference to how Dragon Age 4 is, though.
A good one or a bad one?
It's the reason that it doesn't have a
Oh,
multiplayer
that's right.
component.
Yeah.
Originally, it was going to have live service multiplayer. They talked a little bit about what that version looked like in the press junket for Veilguard, where they're just sort of like, yeah, we had to do some realignment when that happened. Because I guess originally the idea was the sort of like the expectation was that all of it, like very opposite of what the game seems to be now, where they're really trying to push like it's all about the party members. The party members are the entire game. Seemingly at the time, the idea was that like, oh, you will be playing this along, like each person plays an individual character. You will be playing with your friends' characters. You will be playing alongside each other. And that would have been a very different game.
I mean, that sounds neat, but I don't think that's why anyone plays Dragon Age.
Yeah, like if that was a new IP, I think that people might be interested in that. I don't think that there was a world where people wanted that to be Dragon Age 4. It's the reason that Neverwinter Nights isn't Baldur's Gate 3. But or see also like how Icewind Dale isn't a Baldur's Gate game either. Like they're different. They do different things with similar tool sets. It's a shame that we don't live in a world where you can do that, iterate that quickly anymore, but them's the breaks.
Indeed. Well, I hope a similar thing happens after the failure of Suicide Squad and they realize that, hey, we have this studio that can make.
We have an extremely high quality studio here that can do things.
Yeah, we can make they can make extremely high quality single player games that we can resell and resell and resell.
Oh, something to remind you about this dialogue wheel, since it's a notable thing that they never did again. How Hawk is going to talk when you don't have control of them is going to be affected by what kind of dialogue option you pick the most.
Okay.
So like if there's a conversation where Hawk just has to say something and you don't have a say in what it is, if you mostly say diplomatic answers, Hawk is going to mostly speak diplomatically. If you mostly say sarcastic answers, Hawk is going to say sarcastic things. If you mostly say aggressive answers, Hawk is going to say aggressive things. So there's like a sort of an the game sort of tries to make sure that Hawk is consistent even when you're not allowed to select what they're saying. It's interesting. It's an interesting take on that system.
And P said we have so many good games that companies didn't have to worry about patents for certain in-game systems. Is this about PAL World?
I'm gonna be real with you. I don't think patents are holding back many games. Patents are rarely game patents are pretty rarely and pretty selectively enforced, especially among the big companies. And evidently, one, companies don't care too much about them anyway, for the most part. And like two, I mean, the resultant game was PAL World. That's me being mean, but I don't think patents are holding back many games. They're largely unenforceable to begin with. Let's see. I'd assume it's mostly all dependent on if the game is actually successful. It is and it isn't. Like success is a big part of it, but it's also just like Nintendo's got a lot of patents, like Sony's got a lot of patents, Microsoft's got a lot of patents. Few, if any of them ever end up getting enforced, for a multitude of reasons. There's some historical reasons for why that is. But suffice to say that yeah, I don't think that there's much reason to to think that patents are holding back a lot of games. Like, the most, because, like, you'll see ones that lapse and then no one actually bothers doing anything with them. Like, the sanity system from Eternal Darkness lapsed some years ago. And, you know, people kept saying, oh, the people would iterate on that if it weren't patented. It's, well, the patent's gone. People don't give a shit. For years, Namco had the patent on loading screen minigames. That went away. Like, they actually enforced that one. You don't see those anymore, even in games that still have loading. Ultimately, the things that you can patent in games tend to be pretty limited. Think about Palworld is that it could have been marketed without ever mentioning or infringing upon Pokemon, which is what Temtem and Cassette Pieces did. Really have to ask, how many people play Palworld because they profess to hate Pokemon? Probably not a significant number, just the loudest ones. Then again, I don't know how much... Like, the thing about it is that Palworld is not, like, a useful substitute for Pokemon, because it doesn't actually play anything like Pokemon. It's a survival game that has, like, knockoff Pokemons in it. And then they gave those knockoff Pokemons guns. It's a really weird potpourri. It's the sort of thing that you would normally see and just sort of laugh at because it's like, oh, this is another one of the, like, dime a dozen weird survival games. But yeah, like, it was really big out of the gate. I'm not sure how many people it retained, is the bigger question. Because, you know, for about, like, because that's what happens with a lot of these kinds of things. It's like, for 2 weeks, everyone's talking about it, and then it's gone, and it's hard to tell how many people are still playing it and how many moved on. Do you know that there are tons of people who say they hate something but have never actually experienced it? Oh, yeah, 100%. Fully aware of that. But, you know, again, a lot of people, like, there's some loud people that say that a lot, but... Yeah, 25K is, like, certainly respectable for ongoing numbers, but it's not exactly a super concerning number for anyone. But yeah, like, the thing about it is that there's not, like, a meaningful number of people that, like, So Palworld, for whatever its peak numbers were, whatever its theoretical peak in the future is... The game that has been produced is not, like, meaningfully a Pokemon threat in most ways. Not because it's, like, not out of any question of how successful it is, but just as a case of it's not, like, the kind of game that it is not really scratching the same itch. And so, you know, it's limited how much that those audiences cross over. Should we talk about the recent Sony and Microsoft online outage? I have not looked too much into that because I haven't actually tried to connect those consoles to the internet recently, so I don't actually know much about that. I saw that there had been a service outage, or at least, like, server issues. Yes. Think that they're mostly resolved. Oh, Lord. Okay, outages report. Okay. Yeah, it looks like it's sort of been up and down over the past day or so. But yeah, I mean, I usually, like, that sucks, but it's also one of those things where it's like, when I'm comparing, like, outages, I'm thinking of, remember that time that PSN was down for, like, a month in 2011?
Oh, God, that was a bad month.
They had to actually give games away as a make-good, and it absolutely tanked the launch of at least one online-focused video game.
That was wild.
I think it was the last Motorstorm game.
That was wild. So I remember at the time, my friends and I were pretty much doing playing everything on PSN.
it's the
I don't even remember what we did. We go back to
Played
Halo? I don't know.
games. But yeah, it, when it, if it what I'll say is if they're still having rolling outages this time when we record next week, then I'll have something to say. But for now, as far as I can tell, it's been like a day or so of like intermittent outages, so it doesn't really seem that concerning. Question that Wheels and Joe answered last week, but I'll bring up because of the online outage. A lot of people have resigned that they won't ever buy physical anime, DVD, and Blu-ray because they're too expensive. Has that number gone up when it comes to games recently, or has Steam reached their maximum theoretical level of popularity? I think Steam's big frontier at this point is mostly just markets where it has either been limited or disallowed for a long time. In general, I think that you'll find that we probably haven't hit the peak number of people that are going to largely switch to digital, but I do think that like we've sort of hit the peak of the speed at which that adoption is going to increase. I think at this point, the kind of person that is still buying games physically has like some sort of reason they're doing it, and until something changes about that, their purchasing habits are not going to change that drastically. What if the economy got worse to the point only 2 out of 10 people have the disposable income to buy new physical games? Well, if that happens, we're going to have a lot more other problems to worry about. That's like some hyperinflation shit. Or just continued stagflation for the next several decades. Or greedflation, any of the horrible inflations. But what I'll say is, like if that happens, companies are going to have to adapt in one way or another. Because if you can't buy physical, there's like the thing about it is that physical games, in my experience, are outside of Steam usually cheaper. Just because, like, you'll get these older games on digital that just like no one ever saw fit to lower their actual price. Or, if you get really fucked over, maybe Sony just decided to raise Horizon's price. Did you guys talk about that?
But what?
Oh, when the Horizon remaster was announced, Sony
Oh,
raised the price of regular Horizon.
no, I don't think we'd seen that yet.
Yeah, for those who missed this charming tidbit, Horizon was digitally $20 for on PS4 for a number of years because it's an 8-year-old game. And they're not Nintendo, so they don't just keep their prices frozen in amber forever. But because Horizon Remastered, for some reason, has a $10 upgrade path, but it's $50 base, they needed to raise the price of PS4 Horizon so that you didn't have a $30 path to getting Horizon Remastered. It's really, really silly. For a remaster that not a single human being asked for or thought was necessary. God, what a weird thing to do.
Seriously.
Why? Just why? Can't like I need to briefly rant about that, 'cause like that is an admission that the thing that you're making is not in demand to go and take the old thing and raise its price so that it doesn't look like a way better value than the new thing you're making. Like, oh, I could get the same thing with quote-unquote worse graphics for less than half the price. Oh, you no, I can't anymore, because if that happened, you are tacitly admitting that the upgrades that you made aren't worth it. Do not justify the price increase unless you artificially increase the price of the old thing. Okay, this is a question from the Discord list. It's from FireMiner. I asked about the low profitability of selling games in developing nations. See how there hasn't been a Switch, Nintendo Select, PS5, the best, or Xbox Series X. Platinum hit. Why have the budget re-releases died out? Because holiday sales on digital marketplaces made them less attractive. You think that in countries with low purchasing power and poor net infrastructure, releasing the hits on discs on discount is a good option? I think it would be. What I would suspect is the problem, or quote-unquote problem here, the reason that companies don't go for this is, my suspicion would be that it creates manufacturing bottlenecks. Like, yes, you could and probably should at least try to be tapping developing markets, but if you're trying to sell to your established markets and you're, you know, making your money by charging premiums there for, you know, your current new product, like, you're making a bigger margin on those, and so you don't want to divert manufacturing capacity to marketing and selling older product in these developing markets. That would be my suspicion as to why this idea just doesn't get a lot of traction. And it's a shame. I think that in both, like, we're watching Microsoft and especially Sony sort of, at least in the U.S., push, and, like, you know, the major markets that they care about, the U.S., Japan, Europe, Australia, they're pushing gaming into being this really, like, the boxes themselves into being these really big ticket items. Like, people look at, like, drop, like, oh, the PS1 or PS2 into inflation calculators, and it'll be like, oh, that costs like the equivalent of $600 or $700 at that time. And it's like, yes, but buying power is not the only thing that matters in this calculation. Like, $300 then is not worth it. Was worth more than $300 now, but $300 psychologically was then still closer to what $300 is now than it is than $300 now is. Like, as the prices of everything else goes up, that, yeah, there's so much happening. Everything's happening so much all the time. But yeah. Now, whenever Sony raises their prices, people are calling it the Concord tax, or the PS5 Pro, the Horizon price increase, etc. The proof that other companies in the Sony group have stepped in and demanded Sony Entertainment to stop bleeding money. They want to recoup the losses and don't want to foot the bill anymore. I like the PlayStation part of Sony is probably its most consistently profitable point. This strikes me as like something that they were gonna try to do anyway. Like, Concord does huge numbers, PS5 Pro would still be $700. The timing of when it was announced, they had made that decision months ago. Realistically, this is a case of just how to put this, Microsoft not being a viable enough competitor. Like Sony is doing like companies are can are have been and continue to price their products in the form of what can we get away with? And we've been deep in the realm of we can get away with like the less viable your competitors, the more you can get away with. Like there's the thing that drives prices downwards is the fear that like they won't that something won't sell at the price it's at. Any thoughts, Wheels?
No. No, I have thoughts on Dragon Age.
Go ahead and have them.
This comment's really fun.
Yeah, it's nice and snappy.
Yeah. Sure.
It's I've been pleased to see that like the Veilguard's combat looks a little more like twos than threes.
I can't remember threes. What was different in three?
It was similar enough to this, but it was kind of slower because it was trying to bring back in the tactical bit. They brought back the tactical camera and
Oh God, oh
such.
Lord.
There was references again by some of the people that worked on it that like tactical camera is one of those things that like it's a huge lift because all of your environments have to work with it.
Ugh.
And it creates it creates a lot of things and problems, and then of course they you can't actually you can't sorry, my head's kind of a mess because I was sick this week.
All good.
But yeah, a tactical camera incurs a lot of cost, and then a lot of people don't use it. But you have to the cursors on the tactical camera have to be able to move in a lot of strange ways that a player character typically doesn't. There's just a lot that comes with it. And ultimately, not a lot of people used it, and so it's gone again in Vanguard, it looks like.
Woohoo!
Let's see. Every person, whoever works on the economics of inflation, should study the case of the subway footlong. I'm convinced that debacle, Jared Fogle, in the very short term, exploitative nature of subway have killed all prospect it ever has. I'd never say never because. Like certain franchises just live forever despite no one actually liking them, but yeah, I think that definitely hurt their growth.
$5 foot long.
But yeah, as Pew points out, like the fundamental thing that causes like prices to be lowered is people stopped buying. And ultimately like no amount of no games and or like anything else has stopped people from buying a PS5 at $500. So they have no desire to lower that margin. So they're just keeping that at 500 and making a new thing at 700. So yeah, the It's, I think it's short-sighted, but it is what it is. A lot has been said about how the jump from First Blood to Rambo 2 reflected the transition from Vietnam Syndrome era to the Reagan era. The funniest thing is that the author of the First Blood novel had written exclusively action thriller and horror novels ever since Rambo blew up. Seen highly creative studios like Raven Software being put in the Call of Duty mine. Is there any single individual in the gaming industry who can serve as an example of just that? I think games are a little too collaborative to get away to do that. Like a studio can shift its output, but individuals generally like, unless it's an indie game dev, it's very hard to like identify an individual and it's like their output really changed. just because again, like the whole thing, like even you look at someone like a Kojima, someone that has like both an identifiable style and a lot of clout, you're still looking at someone who is working with the intention of, oof, so someone who is working in a way to avoid, like bankrupting themselves, trying to make sure that they still have funding for future projects, blah 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 blah. It's very hard to make that kind of shift all at once, and still get funding. I'd like to also point out, for Wheels' benefit, the sibling of Hawks that dies in that scene is dependent upon what your class is.
Oh, so it's never it's if I
If you're a
wanted to
mage,
save
your
the
mage.
if I wanted to save the mage sibling, I cannot be a mage.
If you're a mage, your mage sibling dies. If you're a warrior or rogue, your warrior sibling dies.
Oof.
Bethany was generally more popular than Carver, which I think influenced at least some greater proportion of people to not play mages.
Oh God, do I need to
But
restart this and not be a mage?
nah, I think you'll be fine, because like the other thing is that your sibling character like is forcibly taken from the party at the end of Act One in one way or another.
Yeah.
So I think you'll be fine. But oh yeah, new layoffs at Microsoft. There's been more people being laid off this year than 2023, according to Polygon. Like, they took in a lot of people at the end of 2023, so this is not surprising.
No.
It sucks, but it's also not surprising. And the other thing is that, the contractions that led to all those 2023 layoffs, they didn't change. The factors behind them didn't change that much, so we're still in hell, baby. See. Just check the Discord.
Well, you get the, didn't get the chance to talk about the Lunar Remaster.
Oh yeah. It's the good versions.
Yeah, looks I immediately went and sold off my PS1 copies before they
At
tank
least
in
it's the
price.
PS1 versions. Oh, I'm sure there will be plenty of people that want the PS1 versions for one reason or another.
Oh, for sure. I just think regardless, they will go
You're
down in
not going to be that
price.
person.
Yeah, I'm not going to be that person, one, and even there will still be people that want them, but less people for
Could
sure.
be smaller. But it looks like they're based on the good versions. I don't really like anything that the remastered graphics are doing. I think all of those ideas are kind of bad looking, for with because like they're doing some sort of like half HD 2D stuff, but the that stuff doesn't work when you're just sort of leaving in place as much of the original graphics as you are, and then like the widescreen doesn't really feel, well, it looks like it will look acceptable if you turn those off. I think you can turn those off, so it's like, hey, at least you can play fucking Lunar 1 and 2 on modern platforms. That'll be nice. I'm stupid, I'll buy that. I really like Lunar. I've played them so many
Yeah, it's
times.
gonna be time for me to finally play through those for sure.
Yeah. Saving them for a rainy day?
Yes. Yes. No, I don't have a good excuse. I used to obsess over like the cinematics in those games. But I didn't, when I was doing that, I didn't have the money to buy copies. And then when I finally got copies, I don't know, I never sat down and just played through. I
Listen,
think, I don't know.
The first two games, I sold to such a degree that I can sing the fucking vocal songs from them by heart without actually looking anything up. So I don't get to talk. I'm just wishing on a dream that seems far off. No, I'm stopping. but yeah, Fireminer brings up the allegedly the reason the Genesis Mini didn't have any didn't have either Lunar was because of Victor Ireland asking for too much. I've heard that same story too. I think the problem in that one came down to like something to do with voice acting. Like, I think the voice acting might be the thing that he most has some sort of claim to. But it's messy. I don't know how the rights are split up on that. But it seems like they worked something out. I would imagine that it was deemed that re-releasing Lunar on all modern platforms probably had more of a profitability chance than releasing it in a giant bundle of Genesis games on a, you know, miniature Genesis. Isn't it weird that while Microsoft has the least to lose from emulation console jailbreaking because most of their games are on PC, their consoles are always the hardest to crack? While Nintendo have the most to lose, yet their consoles are always the easiest to crack. Another Switch emulator got killed recently, but we still haven't got a good OG Xbox emulator. That has as much to do with the fact that the kind of person that cares about writing emulators doesn't give a shit about the Xbox library. Like, that's historically been the problem. Like, the reason people, like, fight so hard to get Nintendo games running on everything is because they want to play Nintendo games. And there's never going to be an official way to play a Nintendo game on your PC or whatever, if for the foreseeable future, whatever. Like, whereas, you know, like you point out, a lot of the big Xbox games ultimately made their way to other platforms where you could play them or are officially on PC. So, like, yeah, me and, like, a dozen other sickos want to play fucking Jet Set Radio Future and Breakdown and fucking Gun Valkyrie, but me and a dozen other sickos are a much smaller demographic than the, like, million or so dudes that are like, I would like to play Tears of the Kingdom and I would like to not have to buy it on Switch. Like, that group of people is much larger. And the easiest way to solve a technical problem is to fire as many engineers at it as possible. there's also some other stuff, like the Switch is a mostly reasonable piece of hardware based on mostly known specs. The desire to play exclusive Switch software is high. There's a huge desire to get, you know. The other thing is that, of course, when your system does get cracked in that fashion, you need to, like, there is a desire to protect it because you need to make it clear to your third-party partners, hey, it's still safe to release games on our platform. They won't all get pirated to shit. Mm-hmm. So, but between all those things, it's like, yeah, I'm not happy that, like, people are going to have to start from scratch on Switch emulation again in, like, 5 years or whatever. But I'm not surprised. But, you know, like, desirability of software is a key arbiter on this, and there's just not, like, stickos like me want to play weird old Xbox games, but also, you know, like, the marquee tentpole titles that people would want to play on other things are available on other things. You can just play Halo on your PC. And that really dampens the effort to get people on board with, like, we need to get original Xbox emulation working, or we need to get 360 emulation working. So many 360 games just came out on PC. Why would I care? Now that UFO 50 is about to come out, it's weird to look back at Derek Hughes' previous work and realize that while people can still feel the impact of Splunky 1 and 2 today, almost no one remembers Aquaria. Man, I remember Aquaria. That was a weird game.
What is Aquaria?
Aquaria?
Yeah.
Yeah, let me double check to make sure I'm thinking of the right thing. What I'm thinking of. Yeah.
Man, there's a lot that happens in the opening of this game. Holy shit.
Yeah, it's a lot. I seem to recall it's essentially a Metroidvania of some description.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it's a nearly 18-year-old indie Metroidvania kind of construction. No matter how good it was not going to reverberate the way that something like Spelunky was, because Spelunky is, you know, kind of a pioneering action roguelike-y experience. And, like, I feel like when it came out, it was a little more, like, both indie games had more spotlight on them, and it was more out there. Like, it was a more unique prospect. Where Aquaria, no matter how good it was, a lot of that first wave of indie game was 2D side-scrolling artsy exploratory platformer. Like that was a really, and there's again the problem of it was 2007 and the amount of spotlight on any given indie game was quite small, even if it was an acclaimed and celebrated one. Okay, hello, Ninja Gaiden Black and Unreal Championship are still in the Xbox dungeon. I mean, I love Ninja Gaiden Black, but you run into the issue that a lot of people seem to think that Sigma is an acceptable substitute. They're wrong, but those games are still available. And, man, people don't even play Unreal Tournament anymore. Unreal Championship is a niche in Unreal Tournament fandom. Also, as I recall, it was only Unreal Championship 2 that anyone had any fondness for. Unreal Championship 2, the Leandre conflict?
Yes, that one was interesting and fun. Unreal Championship 1 is just like a slightly altered version of Unreal Tournament
2003, I think.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't even the 2004 update. I think it's just basically an alternate. Yeah. Yeah, Wikipedia is claiming that Unreal Championship 1 is basically a port of Unreal Tournament 2003.
P says, "Let me some Unreal Tournament. Still have my discs." So do I. Why the hell didn't we do an Unreal Tournament stream instead of Anthem?
Unreal Tournament, all versions.
Yes.
Okay, we've got some more stuff. One, let's see. Double Dragon Revive might not use AI art, but it still looks pretty cheap. Now that the original creators have stepped in to say that the game does not respect the original, I want to ask, when it comes to licensing games, is the IP holder being a bit high-horsey a good thing? I've asked about Ava merchandise, and yes, a bunch of Ava toiletries might not be that great for the franchise, but the customers can ultimately choose not to engage with them. I think on some level it's useful. Like, one of the things that's important when you start doing cash grabs is that you need to be careful that people don't start thinking, oh, I can't trust whatever has this branding on it to be good. Like, part of the reason that you'll see companies that have, like, infinite money spend forever on a game and take... and just can products that seem to be nearly complete is because reputational damage would make it harder to sell future products. And so, yeah, you like if you look at something like Double Dragon, no one just trusts Double Dragon sight unseen because there's no reason to. There's so many bad Double Dragons. There's so many of them. Even if you love Double Dragon and you just want new Double Dragon, you can't just trust a new Double Dragon to actually be the new Double Dragon that you want. A lot of them have been quite cheap. And that can be frustrating at times when a company is just sort of like being really persnickety about its brands, but at the same time, at some point, you kind of have to, or else people just don't trust it. You can't do that with a new Double Dragon game. Speaking of Ava and Double Dragon, one reason why they were so liberally licensed comes down to the studios behind them being in deep financial trouble. Is there any other game IP suffering from this fate of being associated with a bunch of terrible spin-offs? Probably a bunch of them, but I think I eventually start tuning them out. It's just like, oh, it's this fucking thing again. I would say that at this point, there's certain these aren't important IP, but when I think of it, one of the things I would think of is like there was an Alone in the Dark game this year, and by all accounts, it was probably the best one that's existed in the last like 25 years. But it's also one of those things where it's like the only time that an Alone in the Dark game comes out is when a Fly By Night publisher is like, we want to a Fly By Night develop, like, you know, a I don't want to say Fly By Night. Some of these games had passionate developers clearly putting a lot of work in, but like a low budget developer, a low budget team being putting together whatever they could based on the fact that Atari is constantly on the verge of collapse. Like that's one of the ones I would think of in terms of this IP only comes out of the woodwork because its publisher just farms it out to whoever they can force to make things for cheap. Let's see. Love me some Unreal Tournament, so my disc law cough, Amazon cough. Oh yeah, a new Sword Art Online game came out. Isn't it weird that Bandai Namco and its subsidiaries are so good at releasing medium budget average video games at a consistent rate that hack fans can only wish? I don't want Dot Hack to be coming out and being like mediocre garbage every week and a half. Like I've ranted about this before. And I'll rant about it again. Like one of the things that makes Dot Hack interesting is that so much of it was had the guiding hand of a guy, Kazunori Ito, who is like who was a le is and was a legitimate like speculative science fiction writer. And so the things that make Dot Hack interesting come down in part to the fact that it that was one of the guiding hands behind it. If like Namco wanted to just contract site and like it was also that and it was also Cyber Connect 2, clearly we're passionate about the franchise. If Bandai Namco wants to pay Cyber Connect 2 to shit out one of those once every like year and a half, I'm not convinced that those things are going to stay there, and I don't want it. I don't want it. I'd like to see something like Dot Hack, or you know, I'd like to see Cyber Connect 2 get to make interesting originals like that, and they do when they can. Like Fuga, it's by all accounts extremely interesting. You know, I don't want to make that devil's bargain of being like, yeah, just anything to get more Dot Hack product, because like. There's a lot of it. There's probably a lot that I still haven't actually engaged with. And ultimately, like, one of the things I like about it is how much it was considered and well put together, and I don't want to lose that.
What so now can you tell me what Doc Hack Fragment is?
Oh, yeah. So Dot Hack Fragment was like. Okay, so the name is a lore joke. The beta title for the MMO that's played in Dot Hack called The World. The beta title for it was Fragment. Dot Hack Fragment was an online multiplayer action RPG for the PlayStation 2 that only came out in Japan. So Fragment was like a PS2 game that kind of played like if you forced the first four Dot Hack PS2 games to be playable in kind of like it's online multiplayer, but it's also single player. It just doesn't have much of a story. You can just like you have you can play with your friends and you can make your own character, or you can play with characters from the first four games and the first anime. And like, it's kind of novel, but it's like the issue is that the first four Dottahack games, like, as games, they're not that good. Like, they're not horrible, but, like, especially if you actually played through all of the first four games, you probably don't need more games that play like that. And so, like, the appeal is mostly for super fans who have not played the first four games in many years and are ready to just play that kind of game but don't want to play the first four games again. It's pretty niche. But yeah, like it's kind of neat that it happened, but like it's as a game, it's probably the least interesting .hack game. Other like I've never finished Link. Link might be as uninteresting as Fragment, but Link had more of a story. It's just probably the weakest .hack story. I don't think Ito had much to do with that one. Yeah, yeah, .hack is a whole mess of whole other can of worms. the fact that most of the mainline .hack content is actually interesting and worth engaging with is something to be cherished. Warhammer games used to be hit or miss, but the ratio of good Warhammer games to bad Warhammer games has been going up. It seems like Games Workshop Workshop's current strategy is to just stick with Focus Entertainment and a few other developers who they know can make good games. Yeah, I would imagine that back when they started granting non-exclusive licenses to Warhammer, that was kind of the ultimate end game they had for this, was that they would work with a number of developers, and then they would sort of find ones that made that worked well with them and produced good content, and then they would sort of like settle in with a set of consistent development partners. So, also thank you for the swift ban action, Pew.
Yeah, thank you, Pew.
But I would imagine that was the thought process that they had even at the time. That would be it worked out for them, and like part of the reason that it worked out for them was that the license was desirable enough to enough small to mid-tier developers and even high-tier ones that they really could just license it to a bunch of developers and see what shook out, and then just sort of like end their business relationships with ones that it didn't shake out with. I really like the art design of Kirkwall. I think it's a city with a lot of character to it.
Especially for a PS3 game, this still looks pretty nice.
Yeah, it's because Kirkwall itself is just like a really cool looking area. I think that this game is going to now ask you to like pick like who's going to help you smuggle into the city, or you know, like who's going to sponsor you to be in the city. This choice doesn't matter that much. It just determines like what of a few different side quests you get in the next act. So don't worry too much about this choice. Just know that there will be a side quest that you can do later, okay, depending upon which one you choose. Let's see. Should check the comment section. Thank you. Thank you, Fireminer. I had not thought to do that. It's been a lot of week. Well, I'm guessing 370 doesn't have anything in it.
Probably not. It just went up today.
Because it appears that you just put it up.
Yes.
I should not have expected different. Let me check.
Oh, yes. I'm going with the elf lady. Screw the other boring looking guy.
Elf. the elf lady, she's eaten, she's like elf, she's gonna eat the cat. You ever think about how they called him Alf, but he gave like an actual normal ass name that he had that just everyone ignored?
I don't remember that. That sounds weird.
His name is Gordon Shumway. Yeah, yeah, I'm hitting you with the Alf lore.
You can't fit that in a pog, though.
That doesn't sound like trying very hard. Gordon Shumway pogs. To avoid wear and tear on the principal Alf puppet, the performers rehearsed with a crude early version of Alf nicknamed Ralph for rehearsal alien life form.
Oh my god. Oh, that's what Alf stands for?
Yeah, Alf just means it's just short, an initialism of alien life form. Which makes it even ruder to not just call him by his name, Gordon Shumway. You ever play the Master System Alf game?
I have not.
I recommend not doing so. It's extraordinarily bad, but it's very funny for how bad it is. God, there's so many more Alf spinoffs than I was aware of. Remember Alf's Hit Talk Show from 2004?
No,
it was called Alf's Hit Talk Show. In 2004, someone made like a talk show version of Alf called Alf's Hit Talk Show.
Alf's Hit Talk Show. Oh my god.
Max in 2020 threatened an Alf reboot. You crave Alf. 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 Alf.
Hugh says, now you can probably revive that talk show with AI.
No!
Ugh. Why is there an option, there's no need for violence, but no option, there's need for violence?
I think usually the aggressive option is there's need for fire.
Oh, here we go. You need to pay what you owe.
You didn't pay me what you owed me. So now it's the world for you.
He says, because there's always need for violence. Yes.
And it's a game that still has a blood spatter engine.
I need to see if I can turn that off. Remember,
I can't remember if you can or not.
I believe you could in the original because I remember turning it off.
Yeah,
it
I think just, you can.
Either turn it off or
it's
turn
really
it down.
Distracting.
It's just ridiculous.
Like, it's just constant. Like, you'll finish. Because, like, so many conversations happen right after a fight. So you just have conversations where people are just splattered in gore. Maybe go into the options now. Oh, wait, you're still in combat.
Yeah. I don't know what this brain icon spell actually does.
Maybe you should look into it. Maybe you should look at your menu and figure it out. It
doesn't seem to do anything.
Now it's over for you. Get into your fucking options, baby. Yeah, having played through all three Dragon Ages over the past couple of years, two is definitely my favorite. Can Veilguard dethrone it? We shall see.
The dwarf guy is the best. I forget his name.
Oh, Varric? Yeah. There's a reason he's shown up in every one of these.
Is he in Veilguard?
Like, he's in Veilguard.
Yes.
Like, once they introduced Varric, they were not going to let him go.
That's good. That's the correct choice.
I can't remember where in 2 it exists, but like, there's a joke that's made about like how Varric is one of the only like dwarves that doesn't have a beard, and the joke is made that it's like, oh, his beard just fell onto his chest. Yeah, there's some dis there's like a I've talked about this before, but there's a good a good video the one of the guys who was the lead on several Dragon Age projects, Mark Dara, did on YouTube, where he talked about Dragon Age 2, and he mentioned that Varric had was a cho like a choice was made with Varric very early on to make to give his writing a lot of time and attention. Like to the point where it's like normally characters who are romanceable get more attention, they get more time, they get more money. Varric got the amount of Varric got the kind of money and time poured into his writing that was normally reserved for like romance options.
So he's not even a romance option?
He is not. There was a period where they considered a kind of joke where at the end of two, since he's the one narrating the story, there was a period where they considered having him basically say, "Oh, did you turn off the gore
Oh,
shit?"
just I forgot to look for it. I got
But
distracted by level-ups.
yeah, there was a period at the end of two
Yeah, here we go.
they were considering.
Enable
They
persistent gore off.
Yeah, they considered having it so that he would his interrogation would be finished, he would meet up with Hawk, and he would immediately like he would basically say, I didn't tell her about us, implying that there was like some sort of romance between Hawk and Varric that had not been that he had carefully left out of his story. And ultimately, they went away from that on the basis that it would overwrite what you it, like. If that was true, it would mean he was that the game was overwriting any choice that you could have made in the matter. And so they had to drop that, even though it would have been funny. See, one important factor. This is from FireMiner. One important factor to Fortnite and Overwatch's popularity is they're playable for the Switch. People would kill for a multiplayer shooter on a handheld, even if the performance aren't that great, like the 2016 Doom port. So why haven't more devs done this? Activision killed Call of Duty handheld games to focus on the mainline ones when while they could have made more money releasing a Switch game. They can't even bother to port Call of Duty Mobile to the Switch. I mean, Activision as a whole seemed to just not trust the platform.
Which is weird.
Yeah, like eventually they started like you can look at some of the things in the catalog, like the Crash Bandicoot Insane Trilogy was a port that was largely spearheaded from within Vicarious Visions. That led to more like I'm given to understand that like Diablo 3 on Switch came from an internal Blizzard pitch, not like higher up at Activision. I get the sense that like when you're looking at like executive leadership of Activision, especially post Wii U, there was just this assumption of like, well, this isn't going to work and we don't care. And when it did, they didn't care to realign the technology powering like Call of Duty to make it work because that was because by that point, especially Call of Duty production was a shitbed. And it was barely coming out at the time on the timetables they wanted anyway. So, like sparing the resources to make it work on Switch would probably have been worth a lot of money, but it also would have been expensive, and it might have delayed the other versions. It might have caused other downstream effects. So they just said, "Fuck it, we don't care." And you know that's probably money on the table. Like, there's a reason that like it probably didn't take a lot of twisting of Microsoft's arms to get them to agree to like make sure that the future Call of Duty games are available on Nintendo platforms because it's like, well, we already intended for these to be multi-platform anyway. And you know, like this gets regulators off our backs, and this is probably a lot of money to be made here. So. No part of that's surprising, but yeah. This is a much slower loading game on PS3. But I'm sure that like I'm sure there were plenty of proposals at various stages to like try to make something happen on Switch with Call of Duty, and then ultimately just the internal dysfunction of like three primary Call of Duty studios that are like rapidly falling behind time as certain projects slip behind time. Like there's just so much that just doesn't that just runs into issues that there's just not space for even an incredibly profitable sounding idea. And again, that's no fault of the developers. The timetable being foisted upon them is simply not super tenable for the scope of the games they were being asked to make. Like this is squarely on executive leadership's heads. Yeah, two had this kind of neat system where like they realized that people like there's so I'm gonna talk about Dragon Age a bit because Wheels is still streaming it. So
That's
Dragon
fair.
Age 1 had this idea of like you didn't have a morality meter like most BioWare games to that point, but you had like approval, and each of your choices would affect the individual approval of each character, and there'd be certain hard lines they didn't want to, that like they were not willing to accept. And most people didn't really like that system. They found that players, like, you know, once you get someone in your party, even if you don't like them that much, it's really irritating if they start like complaining at you or leaving. And so like that system was seemingly deemed kind of a failure. Shortly after Dragon Age Origins came out, they released a DLC that was free. It was just like feast day pranks and gifts. And basically the idea was that it was just a bunch of generic gifts that you could give someone to just game where their approval was on the meter. You could just force it to be whatever you wanted it to be.
God damn, this is a good
And
intro for this character.
it's so good. He's so much fun. But yeah, like they basically like it was determined that that system didn't do what they wanted it to. It didn't create interesting dynamics with the party members. So with two, they created the instead of lowering approval, so to speak, you had actions that would normally lower approval in the prior in Dragon Age 1. Instead, like they gave you rivalry points, or friendship points. Certain characters it's really easy to become friends with. It's actually very, very difficult to become rivals with, like, for example, Varric. Varric just likes Hawk, and basically, the only way to become rivals with Varric is to consistently choose dialogue options that are both dismissive and excessively violent. Because he just like he likes he banters well with Snarky Hawk. He's just a good he's just a fan of Snarky Hawk, and he has a lot of respect for the moral fiber of Diplomatic Hawk. And so it's really only aggressive hawks that can turn into a rival for Varric. But that was kind of the idea, was that you could be a friend, and that would be like your normal positive relationship with a party member that you would have in most BioWare games. Or you could be a rival where like you and that character are both working for similar ends, but are fundamentally aware that you have like a core personality clash and don't like each other that much. But you could actually maxed out rivalry conferred a lot of the same benefits as maxed out friendship, in the sense that like things that would normally cause them to leave the party, basically, would not do that anymore. Like if you fully maxed out your rivalry, there was some sort of respect between the two. And especially strangely, You could get in a romance with a character you had as a rival instead of a friend.
That's weird.
It's a really strange system. It's really interesting, and I don't think it really fully works, but it is interesting, and I think that it was a cool attempt to make. Let's see. Should we talk about the failure of the Princess Maker franchise to never have gone beyond the Shadowcast by 2, while 4 and 5 are pretty good games on their own rights? I'm not the like I think that's an interesting discussion.
There's
I'm
five of
not the one to have it.
those.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. That kind of life sim is not something I'm super versed in. I do actually want to plug, like, as though we have much of an audience, I do want to bring up, in case anyone does not get the same YouTube recommendations that I do, there was the I saw a pretty interesting video on YouTube by a channel, like a channel slash streamer slash speedrunner named Punchy, who was just talking about the extreme failure of Konami's Tokimeki Memorial 3 that super killed big budget dating sims in Japan, which is a fascinating thing to it's like an hour and a half. It's like a decent overview of the success that the series had seen before that and why that third game failed, which is to say that it's a very like it's a deeply misguided video game. But yeah, like I would recommend that. The channel is just called Punchy, and it's a good video. Recommended. If you're into the history of that sort of like this genre was very popular in Japan for a period, and then it just sort of like receded into being an extreme niche. Let's see. Princess Maker 5 on Steam is seriously wrong though. Like some bugs fundamentally make the game unplayable. That's a shame. That's not surprising, but it's a shame. Let's see. Still waiting for Princess Maker 2 Regeneration, but I would like more of other Gainax associated games like Alicia Dragoon or Musashi to get more love. I love Alicia Dragoon. I don't think that there's a huge audience for people that would play a remade Alicia Dragoon in this day and age other than like hardcore Gainax weirdos, but it's a neat game. That was on the Genesis Mini, actually. The first one. The one I actually own. Yeah.
This game is way better than the first one.
Yeah. It's a really focused game. Like the issue people took with it is that it has very limited dungeon environments. And that is true. That is a fault of it. I think that it's ultimately interesting. I love that it really bucks away from the BioWare formula to that point of like they had gotten pretty comfortable with like the post-KOTOR sort of structure that Dragon Age 1, Mass Effect, KOTOR, they all share. I love that this game is that Dragon Age 2 is really focused on like one place and how it changes over the course of time. And seeing like these conflicts sort of cooking in the background over the course of a few different period like a few short bursts of conflict over the course of like 7 or so years. I think that the cast is really interesting. It has some of the most interesting like intra-cast conflicts and ultimately like some of the most like wild choices that you kind of end up having to make about like even though you are put in a position where you can't fully affect the outcome. But your response at the end is kind of a big thing. I think there's like one specific thing where they drop the ball on the final conflict. I think that and this is something that people who worked on the game seem to agree on, that there's like a boss that if you make a certain choice, you shouldn't have to fight them, but for reasons of like, well, we're making the end game and we want to have as many of these bosses as possible, they make you fight them anyway. Yeah, and that's a bit of a shame, but ultimately I think that this game's really, 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 really interesting. I would almost describe it as like Dragon Age Majora's Mask. In the sense that it's using a lot of assets, but it's really thinking very differently about how to use them. And ultimately it ends up focused on some really interesting ideas that I don't think were fully appreciated when it was new. But it's really cool. I love Dragon Age 2. I think it's super underrated.
I think Dragon Age 1, well, I've said this, obviously think this, and I've said this a lot. I think Dragon Age 1 is extremely overrated. Although
Oh yeah,
that's
definitely.
again speaking from I played the PC version. I did not play all the way through the console version.
The thing is that I would say that Dragon Age 1 is a game that's 50 hours long and has maybe 30 hours of worthwhile content.
I would agree with the what strikes me starting this one over again is just how much has happened in the short time I've played it.
Yeah, this one.
Whereas, I was just gonna say, like, just wandering around, so much time is spent in Dragon Age 1 just wandering around, not really doing much. And it's just felt like one of the many side effects of trying to be like the next Baldur's Gate, trying to play exactly like
Yeah,
that.
the specter of trying to live up to Baldur's Gate really hurts Dragon Age 1. There's also just like there's some places like the Deep Roads. That's like a 5 hour dungeon. Yeah, there's no reason for it to be that long. You could comfortably cut huge portions of that. There's the Fade. I would cut that entirely. Not entirely, but like the majority of the gameplay around it, I would cut, which is kind of a problem because like the Broken Circle side quest there is kind of the core side, like it's supposed to be a core story mission, but it's kind of like that's most of the gameplay, and it's like, well, I'm sorry, but like the game is better without the Fade. But yeah, there's just a lot of little things that I would just like cut that, cut that, cut that. There's a lot of fat on that game that I would cut.
But I think it's just stuck with so many people. Just the story and the world were very interesting and well done. That despite all that, obviously,
Yeah.
stuck with a lot of people.
Yeah, let me see if I can pull something up because I'd like actually written a little about this at one point. Okay, let me see if I can find this. Yeah, this might not this might be a non-starter, but basically like the oh wait, yeah, I found it. But yeah, like I always felt like people fell in love with like some imagined version of Dragon Age much more than like
The
the
game I actually played.
actual. Yeah. Okay, not that. I just want to pull up what I'd written before because it'll be more coherent. Okay, that was when I was thinking about Inquisition. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I can see exactly when I was playing. Okay. Let's see. I was describing it when I was playing it at the time. It's a very of the moment game, and one that fans of BioWare and the franchise tend to look back on very rosily. I find as I play it that it's a game where a playthrough is basically guaranteed to take at least 40 to 50 hours, and about 15 to 20 of those will be spent on content that doesn't really work. BioWare games of this era are very much composed of a number of individual conflicts that inevitably delayed resolution, the greater scope conflict. Can't find the star maps because the Wookiees are hollering about something. Can't find information about Saren until you've resolved the conflicts on the planets you've been told about. Can't get people to cooperate and kill a big evil dragon until you convince them all to abide by an ancient treaty by resolving their internal squabbles. That last one is Dragon Age Origins for those who never bothered. Typically, there's going to be some conflicts that work in the setup and some you just kind of do because you can't skip it to finish the game. A couple of hours resolving the story quest and you're moving on. Dragon Age attempts to interlock a number of these quests in a way that just doesn't really work and drags most of them down. And the ones that don't interlock tend to have their own issues. I think the one that illustrates why this doesn't really work is probably the most infamous. There are three interwoven quests that, when examined as a whole, probably make up a third of the game's total runtime. A zombie attack on a village, a demon invasion of a tower full of mages, and a quest for what amounts to the Holy Grail mixed with the Shroud of Turin. Doing one of these quests essentially ends up forcing the player to do the other two in fairly rapid succession before you can really consider any of them complete. You could technically find the Holy Grail first, but you'd have no incentive to bother. You're supposed to do it at the tail end of the village invasion quest. But you already had to interrupt that quest to solve the mage problem unless you ignored all the game's promptings and solve that in a way that is both dissatisfying and flagrantly suboptimal, and which the game will needle you about if you did things that way. On an individual level, two of these quests are fine, nothing to write home about, but solid enough, and they have their moments. The quest for the Grail ends up on a dungeon that feels about twice as long as it needs to be, but it's not per se fundamentally ill-conceived. Unfortunately, both are attached at the hip to the Mage Tower, which forces the game into a very out-of-place gameplay concept. 70% of the Mage's Tower ends up in this weird, awkward Metroidvania concept inside an endless feeling loop of sepia tunnels. Experienced players are also incentivized to always do this section first because it offers a bunch of permanent stat upgrades, around 24 points, the equivalent of 8 levels worth of stat points in a game with a level cap of 25. They won't all be in stats you care about, but there will be at least a level's worth no matter what your build is. You kind of leave a lot on the table by not going and doing that immediately. Sadly, it's also the most dull content in the game, so for new players, it's going to probably interrupt a storyline they were more interested in, hence why they picked it before the tower. And for experienced players, it has to be done sooner than later to not spend the entire game playing pointlessly suboptimally. It's not like you can skip it, unless you use a mod for the express purpose, but that isn't the intended design, so we're ignoring that for now. Sorry, I'm just reading this entire essay, because I had a lot of thoughts at the time. So one bad egg there, and one overlong dungeon along with it doesn't spoil the thing, right? At that point, though, we're looking at about half of a huge quest line being padded out with unenjoyable content, and that's basically all of them. The Dwarven Succession plotline that makes up another huge chunk of the game has similar pacing issues, albeit not ones that force you to go do what was presented as an entirely separate plot before the player gets gotcha'd. Orzammar is the most realized area of the game, the part that forges the closest thing to a real identity for the setting, and which has probably the least tedious form of late-aughts dark fantasy that the game is trying very hard to hew to. The succession crisis itself is mildly interesting, as you have a choice between someone who's personally upstanding but an utterly feckless ruler, versus someone who's definitely done murders in pursuit of power, but is doing so for the sake of very necessary social reforms. Nothing earth-shattering, but there's a conflict you can sink some amount of teeth into. Unfortunately, a ton of its content is wrapped up in a dungeon that's at least 5 times too long, multiple hours of exploring a single tile set. The deep roads are like a perfect exhibit A for this content is not bad in a vacuum, and you don't save much time or money from cutting it back to being smaller, but you should anyway because it is distracting from better content. And that is kind of Dragon Age Origins in a nutshell. There's a lot of weirdly paced and configured stuff that forces the game into a shape where it feels like there's no good route through it. You're going to have to just put up with a lot of nonsense to get to the parts you care about, no matter what those are. And not just that, but that the parts you do like will inevitably be interrupted by parts that you don't... will be inevitably interrupted by parts you don't, no matter what those are, because the attempts to interlock the content. It's a game that has accrued a weird reputation that feels less to do with what it is and more what it represented to a significant portion of the formative fan base the franchise acquired. To them, Dragon Age Origins is the last attempt to rebuke what the Western RPG was becoming and harkening back to an imagined version of Baldur's Gate, where that game's combat was the peak of computer-focused RPG form and the illusion of scope and tactics were given equal primacy. It is a blue sky for what could have been the Western RPG going forward that was summarily heavily retooled back and forth for its successors. Dragon Age Origins represents a dream for a portion of its fan base, even if huge portions of the game suck badly enough that some of the most common mods to the game just cut them out entirely and replace them with nothing. And that is absolutely what they did. Like, there is a Skip the Fade mod and a Skip the Deep Roads mod. And both are the two most popular mods for Dragon Age Origins.
That checks out.
Okay, I want to hit some questions Fireminer dropped in the chat. Speaking of Musashi, will Tetsuya Nomura only work on Final Fantasy World Ends With You and Kingdom Hearts games from now on? He did work on character supervisor on the Mario RPG remake, though. I suspect that, like, just by dint of practicality, that's probably about all he's going to be working on. Like, he's brought up that, like, yeah, I don't know how many games I have left in me, and I want to leave Kingdom Hearts in, like, a reasonably finished state. So, like, the implication is that, like, Kingdom Hearts 4 is going to be the start of a new plot line, but it's probably not going to be near as long a plot line as Kingdom Hearts 1 through 3. I think on some level he's come to terms with the fact that he's going to just have to accept that these are the things that he will spend the rest of his career making. Knowing how long games take and what obligations he still has. As much as people like to clown on Square Enix Japan's business strategy, they still have some of the best workers and creative directors in the industry. Oh, absolutely. Like, it's just a bad executive team, but I mean, that's we got a lot of those. Like, even their failed mobile gacha games like Engage Kill are still leagues ahead of most mobile gacha games in terms of design and visual. Yeah, Square still has, like, a ton of extraordinarily talented artists and game designers and directors, and, like, you know, anything sub, like, C-suite are still some of the top talent in the industry. It's just, oh, goddamn, that C-suite. But yeah, I would suspect that if Nomura ever makes another original IP, it will not be more than a one-off. I don't think that there is... I simply, given his obligations and what he seems committed to finishing, I don't think there's time. Like, I think the last chance he had to do that was when he was deciding what to make, like, whether to forge full steam ahead on Kingdom Hearts 4 or to take the opportunity that he had, like, kind of carved for himself and kind of hinted he wanted to do and make Viram Rex the FF takeoff that exists within Kingdom Hearts 3 that has now had some amount of its canon folded into Kingdom Hearts. But he's I think said on a few occasions that he's, like, kind of interested, like, you know, he was tempted to make a Viram Rex game to, like, try to get that off the ground, and I think ultimately it was just like, I gotta work with the game that I you know, he feels a sense of obligation to, like, I gotta make sure that Kingdom Hearts, I gotta finish Kingdom Hearts, so to speak. Like, I'm sure after Nomura retires, there will continue to be Kingdom Hearts games, but they're gonna be a very different thing.
Why does it always have to be spiders?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry, man. Oh, fuck.
So many spiders.
There's a spider. Deep in my soul.
Spiders from Mars?
Been here for years. You just won't let me go. Got a mean bite. Now he's ready to fight and stand up for what he knows. I don't need your trophies or your gold. I just want to tell you all to go fuck yourselves. Sorry, sometimes I think about Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
As you should.
Yeah, I don't like, it's a that's one of the other shames that, like, games take so long and cost so much, is that, you know, a developer can't be gone, can't be working on something else for 18 months and produce like some weird shit like Brave Fencer Musashi, or you know, Internal Section or Racing Lagoon or whatever other fucking like weird late 90s Square PS1 game you want to bring up, because there's a lot of them. Or Einhander. Remember Einhander?
I do, shockingly. Tobal number one.
Tobal number one and Tobal two. We didn't even get Tobal two. Einhander. Some of the Einhander devs were actually rolled into the team that made the gummy ship segments in Kingdom Hearts 3. Like, they, like, Nomura talked about tracking them down within the company and pulling them into the team to do that. But, yeah, it's just, you know, like, the fact that games take a goddamn long and cost a goddamn much is the reason that we don't get things like that anymore. And it's a shame. I would love for games to cost less and you know, take less time, because then we could get weirder ones. Yeah, this is kind of an interesting character concept, just sort of looking at like, what if we made a very nice, pleasant blood mage?
What's the deal with blood mages again?
Blood mages generally have some sort of demonic pact involved.
Oh, fun. She doesn't seem to like sarcasm. Should I keep doing sarcasm with her? Yes.
He could be rivals.
No.
But, yeah. Oh yeah, there's like a bit partway through the game where like you're confronted with like a demon that tempts one of your party members to betray you. And you know, it's temporary. You win the, like, if it succeeds, you get a fight, and then they rejoin your party. But one of my favorite possible options for that is there's like a pirate lady that you can have join your party, and she just wants a boat, and so the demon's like, yeah, I'll give you a boat. And as she's betraying you, she just says, I like big boats, I cannot lie.
Oh, that's good. That's really good.
But, yeah.
That's good on many levels, because it's like, yes, that's a pop culture reference, but it works even if you don't
like
it.
It works perfectly within the context of what's happening.
That's wonderful.
It doesn't feel labored. It's very good. God, I love Dragon Age. Or I love Dragon Age 2, I should say. One of the things I was also looking at, as I was, because I wrote like some long ass essay about each of the Dragon Age games as I finished them, is that Dragon Age 2 and Dragon Age Inquisition have like opposite problems with party dialogue. Dragon Age 2 has a lot of party dialogue, and all of it's really worth listening to. But if you'll reach point a lot of times where it's like, okay, I'm ready to move to the next area, but if I interrupt this dialogue, I will never hear it. And there's so much of it. In Inquisition, they don't talk enough, and a lot of the game just doesn't have any music in it. So the soundscape is really weird. Especially weird because, like, Inquisition had, like, big open areas, and party dialogue would have made those a lot more palatable. That's neither here nor there.
Well, hey, considering part of it, the composers of the new one, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of music used everywhere.
Oh yeah, there's gonna be some banger music there.
Yeah, fucking Hans Zimmer,
his protege.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah, it looks like they're kind of like they're trying to have more like city zones in Veilguard, To leaven out some of the wider zones, like less focus on big open areas, although there will be those, but more focus on like city zones as well, which is nice because like in Inquisition you got like areas like Orlais that's like, oh, this area that's been referenced, that's like fantasy France, that's been talked about a lot, and then you actually experience it in game and it's like, oh, there's not there's like two streets here, and it's like, oh, that's a little disappointing. So yeah, thankfully they've done something. I'm excited. I'm excited. I'm willing to trust them that they've got this. And again, they've already got it Steam Deck verified, so I at least know what I'll be playing it on. Because I'm looking at Metaphor and I'm like, oh God, playing that on PS5 is going to be hard.
I'm glad I picked up the stupid portal.
Yeah, as long as it works for you, I'm jealous.
Yeah, works well enough in my house at least.
Yep. That's all you need it for. Like, it's convenient.
Yep.
Convenience is important.
No, it's making me actually use my PS5, which is good because I spent a lot of money on that thing. I'd like to make use of it.
Yeah, that'll be a great way to play Metaphor.
Yeah. That's yeah, I'm getting it on PS5 just because of that.
I got it on PS5 because that's the one that I have with disk drive, and I pre-ordered the limited edition.
So did I. I walked and then it popped up again on Amazon and then yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
No, I think I had the Xbox collector's pre-order, and then like no, I went on PS5, so I canceled that and couldn't find the PS5 collector's edition, so I just gave up, but they popped up again on Amazon this week, so
Nice.
score.
Yeah, I'd imagine that Amazon got a better idea. Like, they probably already got them in their warehouses. They
Yeah.
probably have a better idea of how many they have now,
Yeah.
as opposed to the minimum order that they were likely get the minimum guarantee that they were likely given by Atlas at one point. But yeah, so because I'm a sicko, I have to keep with that version. But yeah, that looks good. I'm
Yeah.
excited.
Excited as well.
I haven't bothered playing the demo because, I mean, I already have it pre-ordered.
Yeah.
What's the point?
Gonna have to check myself a little bit until review game done, though.
Yeah. Get hype for review game.
Yes. I think I reset it on stream, so I don't think it matters, but I'm not gonna say it again. Put it on the podcast.
Yeah, just in case.
Because I haven't actually received any embargo information, if there is any, so we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, people usually talk about like I'm going to be like it would hardly be unique to say I'm going to be reviewing X game.
Yeah. It's the one you think it is.
It's the one that would make Wheels review a video game. But yeah.
This is another busy end year because we got new Easts coming as well. So
Oh yeah, Nordics.
I think that one I think is going to be nice to fit in among all this other shit because, like,
Sometimes you just ride around on a boat for a bit.
it's Dragon Age is going to be dialogue heavy, Metaphor turn-based combat, other game turn-based combat, and East just action. Give me some action.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I
that's
am.
that said,
Yeah,
I need to finish Tokyo Xanadu, although I'm looking at the average playtime, I've got about 10 hours left, so although it
you're
should be done
making
next
steady
week.
progress,
It's real good.
but yeah, so I hear.
Good.
Yeah, like what I would say is like, yeah, Veilguard did like absolutely pull in the me audience and like give me a lot more confidence in at least like playing it at launch.
Yeah.
Excuse me, by announcing that it was Steam Deck verified like months ago. has anyone tried Reynatus? I have it. I have not gotten around to trying it because I'm I've been using my Switch time for Ace Attorney, because I just finished Ace Attorney Investigations 2.
Nice.
Which I'd say it's probably like the third best game in the series. It's in that like top tier of the franchise, but it's not like my favorite. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I've been finishing that out. But yeah, I have Reynatus. I'm interested in playing it. I hear it's a nice breezy, like not perfect, but pretty good action RPG that isn't super long. So I'll try to have some impressions as of next week, but I will briefly rhapsodize about Ace Attorney Investigations 2 for a bit, because I really did have a good time with that. What I will say is that I think Ace Attorney Investigations 1 is bad. It's a bad game. Bad is being mean. It's like a 6 out of 10. It has a bunch of weird problems that basically no other game in the franchise has. And it feels bizarrely unconfident. I would say that for everything that Ace Attorney Investigations 1 does wrong, Ace Attorney Investigations 2 does something very right. It has a much more coherent and cohesive story that makes a lot more use of the altered of the different format from the main Ace Attorney games. It has really banger music, where Ace Attorney Investigations 1 has some of the most mediocre music in the series. Investigations 2's like pursuit theme is one of the best in the series, which is a lot, because like the two most important tracks in an Ace Attorney game are its objection theme and its pursuit theme. Because like the objection theme is the thing that plays for the majority of the time when you point out that the witness is lying about something, and the pursuit theme is the thing that plays when you are punching a huge hole in the prosecution's case and often making an accusation of the person who is currently on the stand. It's really important to get that song right, because it's supposed to be the like exclamation point on like, okay, it was satisfying to prove something, and now you're going to get like this really hype music. So it's really important to get that right. And Ace Attorney Investigations 2 has a really good pursuit theme, which helps a lot. But it has like a really like. It has good new characters. It has like a really complex set of mysteries. It has much better pacing than the original. It justifies the collection by itself, even though it's attached at the hip to a pretty mediocre game with Ace Attorney Investigations 1. 2 is absolutely worth it if you are a fan of that kind of mystery-solving adventure game. It's worth it. It's 100% worth it. It's a great little game. But yeah, I just wanted to talk that up a bit, and also bring up like the official like there was a fan translation of Investigations 2 a number of years ago. It's a very good fan translation. The official localization is generally a cut above it, which is not a knock on the fan translation. The fan translation was very good, but the official localization is generally a nicer way to experience it. Like the localization quality that you're getting is that little bit higher. The symbolism of the character names tends to be a little more on point, stronger, and tie the themes together. So in general, I would say, like, even if you've played the fan translation, the official localization is a good addition/improvement. But yeah, big fan of Investigations 2. I will probably replay it sometime in like 6 months to a year. I will God willing, I will never play Ace Attorney Investigations 1 again. I've played through that 3 or 4 times, and it's bad, but again, I'm being mean. It's not that bad. It's not very good. I have there's no emotional need it fulfills in me that would not be better fulfilled by just playing a better Ace Attorney game. So, yeah, but Investigations 2, I will keep going back to because it's great. It's a great one. For those keeping score, the other Ace Attorney games I would consider in contention for the top. Great Ace Attorney Chronicles, when considered as a collective, I kind of treat them as one game because they really feel incomplete without each other. They feel like parts 1 and 2 of one story. I would consider that to be the best game in the series if we are allowed to consider them as one complete work. And then, like, For the mainline series, it's like I'm a big fan of 4, and nostalgically 6, I think, has like it's a little over the top wacky to a degree. I might have dialed down like a notch, but I think 6 has like maybe the strongest suite of cases in the mainline series. Like, you know, you get, you know, 1, 2, 3, like all those are great games. I love them, but there are dud cases in all of them. I think, like, especially 2, 3, 3, 3. I'm not a fan of 3, 2 either. That's part of why, like, I'm going deep into Ace Attorney nerd mode. Like, just ignore me for another minute or so. Part of the reason that I don't hold 3 in the esteem that it used to be, especially used to be, I'm not sure where the fandom is at this point, but I don't hold 3 in the level of esteem that a lot of people did back in the day and probably still do, is that I think a full half of the game might be bad. Like, cases 1, 4, and 5 are good, but 1 and 4 are collectively like maybe 3 hours long, and cases 2 and 3 are collectively like 8 to 10 hours. Like, that's a lot of bad case to slog through just to get to cases 4 and 5. It's real bad. It's real rough. And yeah, and game 2 just has case 3, the circus case, that I don't think I've ever met a single person that wants to go to bat for that. Fireminer brings up that the Captain Tsubasa game came out in English.
Huh. Another one?
Do you know much about Captain Tsubasa?
I know it's a soccer anime.
Yeah, it's a soccer manga that's been running for decades and decades. I think at the time it was initially conceived, it kind of took place when it was being written. But now it's like 20 years in the past.
Huh.
Because, like, it's just not been moving. Because, like, you know, if you're doing weekly chapters that are exploring a soccer game, if a soccer game is lasting more than a chapter, and it's almost always going to last more than a chapter, you're rapidly running out of sync. and the time skips have not kept up. Let's see. Yeah, so it looks like Tsubasa spent a while playing for Spain or something. But yeah, it looks like at the latest it's in the mid 2000s. But yeah.
What did that new game come out on?
Probably everything, if we're being honest. I would be shocked if it's not on basically everything. Okay. Let me see if I can find anything on this. Captain Tsubasa. Okay, I assume it's Rise of New Champions that just came out.
No, it's the 2020 game.
Is it? God damn
Yeah.
it. They keep doing this shit to me. Also, did you purchase the 2020 game?
No, I was just searching on Amazon to see if I could find the new game, and it says the date right on there.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know which one that Fireminer's talking about. Of course, Wikipedia is not listing the games in the order they came out in. That would be too simple.
Let me look on Steam.
Yeah, maybe.
Captain Tsubasa. No, we only see Rise of New
Captain
Champions.
Planet is the hero. God takes pollution down to zero. And he's fighting on the planet side. Okay. Let's see. Oh, yeah, he says it's on Steam. Which game franchise resurrected dead characters that were too popular? Remember when Hasbro did that to Optimus Prime? He whose toys always sell the best. Nowadays, Optimus
Steam.
Prime can't even stay dead. What's that?
Let's see that. See, hold on.
But, yeah. Trying to think of this kind of revival. The most I can think of is actually just that, like, the unwillingness to actually depict Snake, Solid Snake's death on screen in the later Metal Gear games, which was something they kept threatening and playing at, and then there's an implication that he died off screen sometime before Metal Gear Rising Revengeance, but they were unwilling to actually depict it. Despite having made and shown in trailers a scene of him with a gun in his mouth. Does Sephiroth count? I guess. I don't feel like it, but I can't articulate a good argument why. Like, I feel like the contexts in which Sephiroth was has been brought back have been, like, as far as games, sufficiently justified within the fiction. The way I'd put it is, like, in Kingdom Hearts, well, it's fine. That doesn't take place in mainline Final Fantasy. It doesn't super matter. And in the Final Fantasy VII remakes, it's like, yeah, this is before he died. So, of course he would be alive. But that's a whole other can of worms. Yeah, I think I'm gonna say that we should probably call it soon so
yeah,
that I can sleep. Okay. Since I'm still a little under the weather. Thanks once again to Fireminer for providing all these questions and keeping us with plenty to talk about. Okay. What are they gonna say? So, I am going to plug our dear friend and co-host, Michael Baker, Gaijin Monogatari, Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. I'm going to plug his books. He has a number of books available if you enjoy the experience of seeing people's tabletop game
campaigns play out, but you would like more artisanal narrative edge as opposed to semi-improvisational podcasting. And if you would like to make sure that you are not going to have to suddenly feel like, I wish I didn't know this about this person's personal life, as so often happens with people following actual play podcasts, I would recommend Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, which can be found on Amazon in Dead Tree, Kindle, and Kindle Unlimited formats by searching for Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. If you are more the literary type who would like to know more about some obscure and not so obscure Japanese folklore, you can look up Tanuki as a Teapot, which is a collection of various retellings of folklore from Japan, some of which does not have really any other seemingly extant English tellings. Again, Kindle Unlimited ebook or like Dead Tree book, both options. Our dear friend of the show, Smokin' Joe Gamer, is still posting videos to YouTube. So give those a look. Again, YouTube, Smokin' Joe Gamer. There will be some game videos that I know that he's been working on and getting ready to upload. He's always got other things in the pike. Definitely you'll probably see at some point album reviews and guitar stuff, a potpourri of other stuff. Give that a look. As for us, you can ask us questions like dear friend Fireminer did. If you catch us when we are streaming, we stream on twitch.tv/askwheels, typically every Thursday at midnight Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific, until whenever I decide that I am too tired to keep going on. You can also catch our sister show Shenanigans, which is at Sunday, midnight Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific. You can also, if you catch us during those, you can ask us questions in the Twitch chat. If you don't feel like doing that, you can leave a comment under this very episode on rpgamer.com, or you can go to the RPGamer Discord and and go to the podcast section, add your questions there. If you aren't already a member, you can go to the community tab of RP Gamer and click on the, if you click on the community tab, you can find a Discord invite. And that's a lovely community, even if you don't want to talk to us. But, we always like the questions. So if you put those in the podcast section, we will keep an eye out. But that about wraps it up for my brain being able to form complete sentences. So, see ya, Space Cowboys.
See ya.